Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest has written, and this will soon be in book form, a very thought-provoking piece in Orion magazine, America the Possible, a Manifesto, Part 1. And we're going to take a very deep and broad look at where the United States is in terms of our values when you compare us with other advanced democracies in the world. Our guest writes, like you and other Americans, I love my country, its wonderful people, its boundless energy, its creativity in so many fields, natural beauty, its many gifts to the world, and the freedom it has given us to express ourselves. So we should all be angry, profoundly angry, when we consider what has happened to our country and what that neglect could mean for our children and grandchildren. Our guest this hour is James Gustav Speth. He is on the faculty of the Vermont Law School as a professor of law. He was dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. He was administrator of the United Nations Development Program and chair of the Development Group, a founder and president of the World Resources Institute, professor of law at Georgetown University, chair of the U.S. Council on Environmental Quality in the Carter administration, and senior attorney and co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council. He serves on the boards of the National Resources Defense Council, New Economics Institute, and a number of other organizations. He is the author or co-author of 6 books, including The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. We'll be welcoming phone calls. He touches on so many areas that I'm sure this will be a kind of conversation that you want to join. And here is how you do so. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Speth, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning.
It's a great pleasure.
Well, we got a lot on the table, sir. This article just really gets you thinking. Let's start with one of the sentences. Actually, they're all thought-provoking. The data is piling up to confirm that we, America, is number one, but in exactly the way we don't want to be at the bottom. Where are we at the bottom?
Well, on the list, it's entirely too long, I'm afraid.
It's long, yeah.
I looked at the the leading 20 countries of the OECD, the rich countries, well-to-do, affluent countries like us, our peer countries. And then I looked at about 30 different indicators of where we stand on that list. And it's quite depressing. We have the highest poverty rate, the greatest inequality of incomes. We have the worst health system. The lowest social mobility, the lowest score on the UN's gender inequality index, the highest score on several measures of environmental performance, the worst score on several measures of environmental performance, the highest homicide rate. It goes on and on, a list of about 30 things, including spending almost on the military almost as much as the rest of the world combined. So, as I said, the data are piling up that we are at or almost at the bottom in the things that you really would want us to be the best at. And we've let things slide. We've neglected our people. We've neglected our planet. And we have got to take a radically different course, in my view.
Let's start with military spending, because this is astounding that the United States, you write, spends as much on the military as the rest of the world combined. That's a lot of money.
Almost. I think it's actually 43% of the total military spending is U.S. There have been estimates made of the number of military sites that we maintain around the world, and it seems to be about 1,000 military sites where we are. They're not all gigantic bases, but we're garrisoning the world, and spending a fortune on our military. It's the point is when you begin to see things, when you have an arm full of hammers, every problem looks like a nail. And we routinely drift into military actions and military solutions. Meanwhile, outside of this pentagon of plenitude, we are neglecting a host of serious international problems, in addition to the domestic issues that I was ticking off a moment ago. And the most serious, of course, I think, is this shameful behavior on the part of our country in addressing this terrible threat of global climate change. But there are other problems. We're down near the bottom of the list of the well-to-do countries in terms of our support for poverty and humanitarian assistance around the world. So it's not a pretty picture. We are in a system. I've come to conclude at the end of my 40 years of working on environment and development, we're in a system where it's just not delivering. It's not delivering environmentally. It's not delivering socially. It's not delivering economically. And it's certainly not delivering politically. So it's we have got to, as a nation, I believe, step back, take a hard look at what's really going on in our country and what we're doing in the world, and take some very, very different approaches. I know it's against the grain politically now, but we have to get beyond the politics of the moment and think in the longer term.
You challenge us, and I think you're absolutely right about this, that our dominant American values, you're right, are strongly materialistic. And what we need to do is look very deeply at the ever-increasing purchasing of goods and services, the dominance of the corporations, the whole economic structure of this country and our lives, because it's keeping us from addressing the very thing, global warming, which you brought up, which is incredible that we're not addressing this. Part of it is because it calls for some very serious questions about the way we are structured economically. We don't want to do that. We want to keep making money. Corporations want to keep making money. We don't want to think about a different way of life.
Well, I think you've put it very, very well. We, at the core of this, I think, and this is probably one of the most difficult of the messages that I'm trying to get across, at the core of this is what you would have to call our growth fetish, because we seem to attach magical powers to economic growth and invoke it to solve almost all problems. But, you know, the truth is that we've had, if you look over the last several decades, we've had tons of growth, actually. And what we've seen with that is, life satisfaction, flatlining in our country, the environment declining, jobs fleeing our borders, inequality and poverty mounting. It's just, all this growth is not solving the problem, and it's creating a real disaster out there for us environmentally. So what I'm suggesting in the piece, among other things, is the need to move to a post-growth society where we deal more directly with the real problems that we have, including the consumerism issue, as you mentioned, and not always think that the answer is to prime the pump of aggregate economic growth. The economy is back to where it was before the recession in early 2008 in terms of output. But look at the vast unemployment and all the desperation around the country that we have today. So, getting growth back to where it was before the recession hasn't really solved the problems. We've had lots of jobless growth in our country. If we want to create jobs, we ought to start doing it more directly.
I think it's important for us to understand our history so that we can understand our present and where we move ahead. You write in your article in Orion about how America got off course, and you say there are two primary reasons for that. Can you tell us what those are?
Well, sure. I mean, basically, you know, my I've been somewhat radicalized by reality, I think, as I dug into all of this. I think we got off course for two reasons, as you say. One was the we made a good start with the New Deal. I mean, and we put some very good programs in place, and Franklin Roosevelt wanted to do more with his Second Bill of Rights, and we built on that for a while, but then we started neglecting these issues, neglecting the role of government, neglecting the emergence of these problems, and we let them grow and fester. So I think that was the first big thing, was this shift over the past several decades away from the pattern of ameliorative government action at different levels of government that that we launched in the New Deal and carried forward with the Great Society and civil rights and environment and other things. But, you know, since the mid-70s, mid to late 70s, it's been very hard to make progress on, and we've slid badly, as I mentioned, on all of these dimensions since that time. People date some of it from, you know, the Reagan Revolution and his famous statement in his first inaugural that, you know, government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem, he said. And, you know, I think the reality is that, right now government is the problem. He's ironically right that government is a serious problem for us. But it shouldn't be, and it needn't be. And we need to see government at all levels as the tools that we, the citizens, have to make life better for all of us. Mm-hmm. And we're losing that. Mm-hmm. And of course, as we do, we neglect government, and it becomes less able to deal effectively. So we have a problem now. And I think, you know, if I have one recommendation, so to speak, is to build a you know, if I were a young person starting out today, I rather than going into environment, which I still would want to work on somehow, I think I would go into political reform and pro-democracy political reform, because we've got to salvage our politics and our democracy here if we are going to make long-term sustained progress. The other fact is that, of course, during this same era, we saw the rise of the Cold War, the growth of the American security state, now, you know, probably $1 trillion a year going into national security, broadly defined. And this diversion of attention into priorities that stem from this enormous, vast military deployment. So I think those are the two big factors, but, you know, that sort of set us off, got us off track, I think, as a country. Mm-hmm.
And you put this in dramatic terms that we just, maybe this will become a part of the presidential debate this year, I don't know, but when you say it this way, it just knocks you out. The costs, when all told, our wars since 9/11 will cost us over $4 trillion, more than 8,000 American lives, with another 99,000 U.S. troops already wounded in action or evacuated for serious illness. And then, and I'm glad you did this, you make mention of that phenomenal Washington Post report that looks at all the agencies that we have established in this country now, 1,300 government entities, 1,900 private companies working on programs related to counterterrorism, homeland security, and intelligence in some 10,000 locations across the United States. Phenomenal. Is that really what we want to do? We need to, maybe we do, but we need to talk about it.
Well, I think the point that the Washington Post articles, which have about that issue made, was that the even the top intelligence people in our government don't really have a grasp, a full understanding of this far-flung homeland security apparatus that that we've built up. And so that when I use a figure like $1 trillion on security, it includes both the homeland security and our military and CIA operations. One estimate has the U.S. In covert operations around the world in now in don't want to get this wrong, but a huge portion of the world's countries. Now these aren't big operations, but we're on the ground out there and with covert and clandestine operations all over the world. No, it's not a pretty picture, I don't think. And I think we need to think in terms of transformative change. Mm. What are the we've been, and myself included, reformist in our approaches to things. We try to fix this problem with a measure here and a little more there. And we need now to devote at least that same amount of energy to changing the system, if you will, to transformative change. And in our understanding of the priorities that we should be pursuing in the economy and in the way corporations are structured and managed, in the way we run our financial system, in the social conditions, consumerism, cultural values, and our politics, we have can identify about a dozen different areas where deep transformative shifts are going to be needed if we're going to deal with these problems successfully over the long run.
And we'll look at those areas as we go on. Our guest this hour is Professor James Speth. He's a professor at Vermont Law School, author of the forthcoming book, America, the Possible, Roadmap to a New Economy. The first part of what will be a book is published in the current issue of Orion Magazine. If you go to orionmagazine.org, you will find part one of this. Part two will be in their May-June issue. It's worth a read. It's a very challenging to the head and to the heart article. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we will be talking about the life of Malcolm X. And just a reminder that you don't need a reminder that tomorrow are the primaries. You know that in Arizona and Michigan. But tomorrow night at 8, the Ideas Network will be bringing you special coverage from NPR on the Arizona and Michigan Republican primaries tomorrow at 8. To your phone calls now, Linda in La Crosse, our first caller. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for this wonderful show and your wonderful guest. I've thought about this issue for a long time and why we don't have decent health care. And my conclusions are, well, I guess I have two conclusions. One is that the system seems broken to the vast majority of us, but it's not broken for the 1% at the top. And the system is working wonderfully for them. And the second point that I'd like to make is that if we evaluated how everything that happens, how will this affect the community? How is this good for our community? Instead of, is this the most economical? Is this the thing that preserves individualism? Is this what makes the most money? But if our primary value was, is this good for our community? Does this work to solidify our society? Is this good for our young people? If those were our primary values, well, for one thing, we'd probably have a socialist party that would be socially oriented, but we don't, and that is a big problem.
Professor Speth.
Well, I like a lot of what the caller had to say. We really owe, I think, a great debt to the Occupy movement and the various offsprings from that. Because when I started writing the book and the article in Orion, nobody was talking about inequality, particularly. Nobody was talking much about poverty, and they have succeeded in reframing things in a major way in our country. So, you know, the progressives that I know are all hoping that the combination of Occupy and labor and climate and other protests will merge into a new progressive movement that can drive real change. Time will tell. The focus on community, I think, is absolutely appropriate. The good news is, part of the good news, there is some good news, is that, so many exciting things are happening at the community level in our country. There are communities that are taking charge of things that are trying to revitalize in different dimensions, or stressing values of family and community and children. Right now, we have a system of political economy that gives priority to profit, to growth, and to power. We need a what I would call a sustaining economy that gives priority to protecting the real priority to protecting people, place, and planet. And the sooner we have this paradigm shift, the better. And I hope it's coming. I see some good signs, but we've got a long way to go. In terms of I think of the types of prescriptions that I have urged as moving us away from the current variety of American capitalism, but not back to an old-fashioned socialism. We need to invent something new, something that, in the end, it won't look much like we have today, and it won't look much like a lot of places in the world. We'll have to invent a new system of political economy over time.
Is there somebody else, though, some other country on Earth that comes close?
Well, if you look at the data that I mentioned at the beginning about ranking the world's countries, the truth is that the Nordic countries, and Europe in general, is up at the top of that list. We've even gotten to this pathetic state in some of our political discourse that uses Europe as a swear word almost. It's
right.
Really quite amazing, because on these dimensions, there are a group of countries that are doing a lot better than we are, and are at the top of that list consistently.
Thank you, Linda, for your call. Jim in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hello, Kathleen, and hello, Professor. Thank you very much for this program. One of the benefits of being an old guy and an old soldier is that, especially with a good memory, I remember a childhood when it seemed to be we were a real United States going through a depression, coming out of a depression and going into a world war where we did not know the outcome, but we were certainly united. I feel the disparity today that people, I have never felt so put upon, and I'm a union member. Union has gotten to be, say, a dirty word, but I don't believe that. And I do think that there are too many people in prisons. And I know I was reminded that that happened last week. But I, what will take this turning around where we look to the immigrants, and now we're even thinking of Blackwater for fighting our wars and private prisons or going to a privatize prisons to incarcerate immigrants. What is the answer to that, this privatization of everything?
Well, Jim, I couldn't agree more with you. The statistics suggest that the country now is more polarized politically, that is, to use your term, you know, not united, than at any time since Reconstruction. And of course, that's the father of gridlock and deadlock in Washington. And so we're in a real pickle. That's why I mentioned earlier that I think focusing on trying to salvage our political system, first and foremost, by getting the money out of it. What a scandal we're seeing unfold thanks to this Supreme Court Citizen United decision. And I think you're right. We have the world's highest prison population, both per capita and absolutely. And we have this extraordinary drive to privatize things schools, as you say, prisons. There was even a judge that was, I think, found to be taking money to in exchange for filling up some of the private prisons with his decisions. It's and the contracting in the military is certainly extraordinary. So this it all gets back to this idea that that government has to fail, that government can't work for all of us, and that's a very pernicious idea. And so somehow privatizing things is better. Now I've got nothing against the private sector. We need it. We need a better one. But we need some priorities and some steering set by government. We need, we're in an era where we have a third-rate government when we badly need a first-rate one.
I want to talk more about the business of transformative change. I like what you wrote in the piece when you highlight what should be dominant cultural values, from having to being, from getting to giving, from richer to better, from separate to connected, from apart, from nature to part of nature, from transcendent to interdependent, and from today to tomorrow. My question is, that sounds wonderful, but how do you achieve transformation? I mean, that's just a huge thing to do, isn't it?
Well, none of these changes that I talk about are going to be quick or easy. I think the interesting thing to me about value change, about cultural change, is that we know some things about what makes it happen or how it can be furthered. I think it was Patrick Daniel Moynihan, a former senator, who said the central conservative truth is that culture, determines the fate of societies, but the central liberal truth is that people can change their culture intentionally. Unfortunately, the big driver of cultural change is calamity, crisis, the Great Depression was set in motion a huge series of changes out of that crisis. I think that, if we can anticipate crises better, that will move things in the right direction. But in the end, we probably are going to see some serious crises of many types, and they can be learning experiences. They can be teachable moments. We know that leadership is very important in shifting cultural values. We need transformative leadership. We know that education of different types, including social marketing, can shift values. We know that people's religions can, you know, a very powerful force for change can come from our religious institutions, and on and on. I mean, there are things that that we can do to move values in the directions that you that you listed. Mm-hmm. In a way, you know, these values are not foreign to us. They're there, buried often, and the psychologists tell us that, you know, what our responses are triggered by things in the environment. And right now, those the part of us that gets activated, so to speak, us motivated, are the values that, you know, that we should be worrying about. This materialism and our focus on the contemporary and our focus on ourselves, and we should be arranging things in our society to bring out the better values that we do indeed share.
Thank you, Jim, for your call. Cody in Oshkosh, hi.
Well, we talk about this catastrophe making change, and the New Deal was one great thing that came out of the Depression, but also we dumped millions of dollars into corporate America, the military-industrial complex, and I think it wasn't so much Reagan that made the change, but he co-opted that corporate power and used it to his benefit. And another thing for transformative change is the one way to do it is through education, and our education system wants to concentrate on math and science and technical issues all the time, when we need to produce good citizens that really understand all of these things that your guest is talking about.
Yes, Cody, I agree. I think the there is a real people do need education that can prepare them for jobs in this new world and new economy. But the bottom line is that you know, we would sort of get we would be making a huge mistake to think that that is the core purpose of education. Education, which I've been in for a lot of my life, you know, has got to be all about finding the things that really matter, understanding the world as it really is, and not just the scientific and technical world, but the world of society and politics and life. You know, people, and I think that you know, we need to rediscover that that emphasis in our education, civic virtue. It's something we don't hear much about.
What is it about the times in which we live that has you saying things like, if you were to do it over now, you would become a pro-democracy political reformer and devote your life to that, and that you now believe, you used to believe in reform, but now you believe in transformative change. What moved you in a different direction? What happened?
Well, I've had these, what you might think of as kind of establishment, mainstream positions for you know, most of my life. I began when I went into academia as a dean at Yale to look back over, you know, what had we really accomplished. And my first look was in my own field at environment, and you know, after all the efforts of several decades, if you look at the big trends in environmental quality in the world, you know, we're still losing badly. Climate is, you know, making it onto the radar screen, but biodiversity loss, fishery loss, forest loss, soil loss, you know, all of the big trends are toxics in the environment. All the big trends are quite negative. You know, they're positive signs and things are not as bad as they would be if we weren't acting, but they're the more I looked, then I saw that these problems were linked to other problems. I mean, how can you get the priority on the environment in the United States when, you know, 40 to 50% of the families are really just getting by? I mean, not doing well at all in our society. 50 million people in poverty, and another huge group of people at less than twice the poverty threshold. This is not a setting in which environment is going to command the field. And politically, the environmental community doesn't really work on political reform, but they're losing badly in Washington today. And unless we get the politics straightened out, we're not going to make the kind of progress on environment that we want, or much of anything else. So these issues all kind of began to come together for me as a framework. And so I began asking myself, why are we failing across such a wide front?
Mm-hmm.
And the conclusion I came to is that, when you have encompassing problems like our country now has, it can't be due to small reasons. It's systemic.
Mm-hmm.
The system is generating these problems, and we have got to think of system change. So I love the little slogan, system change, not climate change.
Our guest this hour is Professor James Gustav Speth. He's a professor at Vermont Law School, author of the forthcoming book, America the Possible, Roadmap to a New Economy, and he has the broad outline of that roadmap in the current issue of Orion Magazine, part one of an article that will ultimately be a book. Part two will be May through June. He has a fascinating background. He, in 2009, completed his decade-long tenure as dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. He was administrator of the United Nations Development Program. He was founder and president of the World Resources Institute, a professor of law at Georgetown, chair of the U.S. Council on Environmental Quality in the Carter administration, senior attorney and co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council, the author of several books, a graduate of Yale University with a BA in political science. He studied at Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar and got his law degree from Yale, and he served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black. We're welcoming phone calls for Professor Speth. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, the editor of Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Unfortunately, the author of this book, which took 10 years to put together, Manning Marable, died. So the editor will be with us to talk about Malcolm X, who some would say stands as the definitive, this book, the definitive work on one of the most singular forces for social change, in a very complicated and extremely interesting man. So that will be tomorrow during this hour. And Senator George McGovern has a book on being a Democrat. He will be with us Thursday at 10 o'clock. Back to phone calls. Scott in Columbus. Hi.
Good morning, and thank you. It's a great program. This move toward privatization that we've seen over the last 30 years, roughly, is I think is ideologically and profit-driven. It's profitable for the very few and costly for the vast majority, and your first caller alluded to this idea. And it's resulted, I believe, in our higher income and wealth disparity. And when we lose our sense of shared destiny and a move toward social Darwinism, every man for himself, it's easy to exclude large classes of citizens, and I believe that's what has happened in this country. It was about a year ago, I believe, that I heard on the BBC a Brit who was interviewed, who had published, he along with another researcher, had published a study of comparing high income and wealth disparity countries with low income and wealth disparity countries. And these are all developed countries. And of course, the U.S. was one of the prime examples of the higher income and wealth disparity. And what this study clearly showed was in this country, we have, with our higher income and wealth disparity, we have higher rate of incarceration, higher rates of mental illness, higher rates of violent crime, and higher rates of poverty. So there is a price to be paid, and make no mistake, for the social Darwinism, privatization, and make no mistake, we are paying it. And it is the 99% who's paying it, not the 1%.
Thank you, Scott.
Hey, Scott. I love that. The book is called The Spirit Level by Wilkinson and Pickett, two British sociologists, the one you mentioned. And I think the what they show in there, they have an amazing chart. They on one axis, they have inequality in across the, all the rich countries. On the other axis, they have an index of social problems, including the ones that you mentioned. The United States of America is at the extreme on both. It's almost sort of off the chart up there in terms of it having severe social problems and severe inequality. So, you know, you've really pointed to, I think, a very important study and a very important set of conclusions.
Thank you, Scott, so much for your call. Willem in Colfax, hi.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to say that there seems to be also a very unscientific, you know, sort of a backlash, especially with you know, the trying to, like, an example is I wrote to my senator, Ron Johnson, about the global climate change problem, and he wrote me back that climate change was an unproven scientific theory, and I think that's very troubling when the majority of the scientists in the world agree that it's happening. We're, you know, it seems like we're in this let's burn the last stick in the forest type of mentality in this country, and I think it's really destructive to our environment and to our children's future. And when money and profit become the highest value of a society, I think that's very troubling, and you can't eat money, you can't breathe money, you can't drink money. So, you know, we have to change our priorities. And Abraham Lincoln said that the government should be of the people, by the people, and for the people. And I don't see that. I don't think that's happening right now.
Professor Smith.
Well, this anti-science movement almost across the country is extraordinarily troubling. I mean, so many of our public issues now have a high scientific content. You know, genetically modified organisms, nanotechnology, climate, which he mentioned, and others. And you know, the public you know, needs help on these issues, not hustle. And we're getting, you know, and the public gets hustled all the time. And it's not just kind of that people don't understand science or don't like science and math or something like that. There's a tremendous amount of misinformation being very carefully placed in the media and on the internet, and it, you know, we are being hustled. There's a wonderful book called The Merchants of Doubt, which traces you know, a group of allegedly scientists who have systematically tried to debunk over time, you know, everything from tobacco smoke to you know, the loss of the ozone layer, to climate change and other things. And the author describes this as the tobacco strategy. You know, the idea is just to sow seeds of doubt, therefore delay ameliorative actions. It is getting totally out of control now.
That must drive you crazy, considering how you have spent your lifetime and what your background is, doesn't it?
Well, It does drive me crazy, I think, a little bit. One thing it drives me to do is write things like like this article and the book.
And the book, right.
Because that helps you keep sane, and I hope people will read the Orion piece.
I hope they will, too. Can we put that on our Facebook page, Rhonda? Yes, we can do that. We'll put it on our Facebook page, too, because some of you want to go there. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. It will be posted a little later after we're off the air. Judith in Dubuque. Hi. Hi, Judith.
Judith?
Yeah.
That's me.
That's Well, by golly, hi, Judith.
I hope I'm not too late to get an answer. It's really a short question. You're preaching to the choir here. Everything you've said, I've basically bought, if I didn't know. My question is, how do we start changing this? I mean, you get one administration in, they start regulating. The next administration comes in, they deregulate everything. I have a feeling, and maybe this is paranoid, but I have a feeling that most of our candidates for president and other offices are actually picked for us. We don't have that many choices. They have to have so much money behind them. How do we even begin to change this?
You started in Madison with those protests.
And, I was there.
I'm a great believer now in protest and demonstrations and even nonviolent civil disobedience. I think people are going to have to speak up and speak out and move these issues. And I think the I got arrested, my first arrest.
Did you really?
I was, protesting the tar sands pipeline in Washington.
Uh-huh.
Spent three days in the central cell block of the D.C. jail.
My.
Good for you.
And, we made our point. So far, we're winning that one. I think that... I admire the people that are willing to put it all on the line. I think we've gotten to that point.
I do, too. Tell me this. Are the protesters still out there? Is Occupy still out there? I don't hear anything anymore.
Well, police have behaved rather badly, but I think yes, my understanding is that it's sort of that Occupy is doing a lot of different things. I'm trying to... there's a wonderful website that Occupy maintains, and you can go there and get the you see what all is going on. It's www.occupytogether.org. There's a lot going on.
Thank you so much for the call, Judith. Jean in Eau Claire, and we're running short on time. Hi, Jean.
I'll try to be quick. Thank you so much for discussing all these things. It's been weighing on me for a long time. I was just wondering, the largest group of people in this country are, baby boomer generation. I'm a child of that, and I have a hard time when I talk to a lot of my friends and family that are in that generation and are on the opposite side of things than I am, about convincing them any other way is better or anything else is better. There's a lot of stubbornness. And I was wondering, how do you go about discussing this with someone who's very set in their ways that, I don't see that they even want to change anything. And these are the groups of people that are actually making all our decisions right now.
Well, I believe that things are going to... that people are getting fed up, actually, what you say is certainly true for a great many people and probably a majority, but I think there are a lot of people who are concluding that there's something profoundly wrong in the country, that we're seeing these terrible results emerge across such a broad front, and the next step in that is to see that, that these are driven by a bad system that needs to be changed, and that there is a better alternative. So I think as the country, festers and declines, really, across this big front, people are losing faith in this system. The system isn't delivering on the values it proclaims.
And as it leads to, that one day will lead to a crisis of legitimacy in a way. And meanwhile, if the progressive communities in the country could ever come together, which they really haven't done in the way that they need to, you know, find their voice, find their strength, and become a political force. I know my environmental community, for example, has just really not been that involved in electoral politics. And if demonstrations and protests multiply and this frustration grows, you know, we could really see the birth of a movement for transformative change.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you so much. What an interesting hour. Thank you. Our guest this hour, Professor Gustav Speth, and he is on the Vermont Law School, professor of law, author of a piece in Ryan Magazine, America the Possible, and it is on our Facebook page. It will be shortly, the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thank you, Rhonda Fanning.